A preacher quickly learns that there are some subjects he's wise to steer well clear of unless he wants to handle large correspondence the following week. So it's with some trepidation that I embark on our Bible study this morning, for Isaiah, in this passage we've just read, you will see, addresses not just one such controversial issue, but two: revolutionary politics and emancipated women. In dealing with the first, he's likely to infuriate any left-wing militants in our midst, because he doesn't have much good to say about young anarchists. And in dealing with the second, he will no doubt cause indignation to the feminists amongst us, because the prophet seems lamentably wedded to a male chauvinist mindset in certain respects. However, I've decided not to hire a bulletproof vest for the occasion. On reflection, I felt that if Chief Constable Anderton could face the brickbat, so could I. So this morning, it's politics, women, and the future. And we're going to divide the passage into three sections for our study. The first, verses 1 to 7 of chapter 3, I've called Revolution in the Air. For revolution is very much the subject of these two chapters, in all kinds of ways. The second section, from verse 8 through to chapter 4, verse 1, I've called The Marks of a Pre-Revolutionary Society. And the last paragraph, chapter 4, verse 2 to 6, I've called Hope for a Post-Revolutionary Society. Let's start then with Revolution in the Air and the first section of chapter 3. And I think we can state Isaiah's proposition in these verses quite concisely. When reckless young men seize political power in a society, it is a sure sign of the judgment of God, he says. See now, the Lord Almighty is about to take from Jerusalem and Judah both supply and support, all supplies of food and all supplies of water, the hero and warrior, the judge and prophet, the soothsayer and elder, the captain of 50 and man of rank, the counselor, skilled craftsman, and clever enchanter. I will make boys their officials. Mere children will govern them. Now, it's quite possible that that reference to food and water shortages in the first verse is intended literally, because famine, of course, often is a concomitant of revolution, isn't it? But I suspect Isaiah is also speaking metaphorically there. This supply and support he's talking about is not just food, it's this list of human resources which he's going on to catalogue in verses 2 and 3. God is going to switch off the political as well as the economic life support system of Judah, he says. The people with expertise in battle, heroes and warriors, the people with prudence and supernatural insight, the judges and the prophets, the people with experience and wisdom, the elders and counselors, the people with authority and command, the clan captains of 50 and the men of rank who rule the tribes. Yes, and even those spurious guides that rely on pagan superstition for their influence over the country, the soothsayers and the enchanters and the magicians. They're all going to go, he says. The whole structure of leadership, military and intellectual and political and religious, it will all be dissolved away. And what's going to be left in its place? Why, the Red Guard, of course. I will make boys their officials. Mere children will govern them. People will oppress each other, man against man, neighbor against neighbor. The young will rise up against the old, the base against the honourable. Isaiah doesn't make it clear whether he contemplates that Judah's power elite is going to be eliminated by exile or by execution. But either way, the consequence is the same. The country will be left, he says, in the hands of rash and irresponsible young opportunists who exploit this political vacuum to arrogate power to themselves. I will make boys officials, mere children governors, he says. Well, with responsibility for law and order in such incompetent and inexperienced hands, it's no wonder that the country will degenerate into a jungle of ruthlessness and criminality. Look after number one, survival of the fittest, Do others before they do you. That's the name of the game. People will oppress each other. Man against man, neighbor against neighbor, he put it. And in such an atmosphere of anarchy, the social conventions and the authority structures which maintain order in a civilized society are corroded. Petulant young upstarts have no respect for their elders, he said. The young will rise up against the old. And scurrilous rogues have got no respect for their betters. The base will rise up against the honorable. And the one thing you can be sure about is that nobody will be prepared to accept personal responsibility for the country. Look at verses 6 and 7. A man will seize one of his brothers at his father's home and say, "You have a cloak, you be our leader. Take charge of this heap of ruins." But in that day he will cry out, "I have no remedy. I've got no food or clothing in my house. Don't make me leader of the people." It's fascinating, the slightly comical little cameo that Isaiah's drawing here. Two young brothers, in all that's left of their parental home, their father perhaps purged for his reactionary opinions. "Why don't you take over the reins of power?" says one to the other. "You've got the only qualification that anybody's looking for these days. A cloak rescued from the looters. Why, compared to this pile of ruins we're living in, you look almost prosperous in it." But the nominee for office is reluctant to be press-ganged in this way. "No fear," he says. "A cloak I may have. A solution to this political and economic mess we're in, I do not have. Don't vote for me," he says. Perhaps tacitly, I've seen what happens to would-be leaders these days. I don't want to be the next victim of the coup d'etat, thank you very much. No, don't make me the leader of the people. Taken all together, you see, this paragraph portrays a pathetic scene. A scene of revolution and anarchy. And after the passage of 26 centuries, it is no less relevant or realistic, is it? It was only 20 years ago, after all, in 1966, that school students aged, 15, 16, 17 years of age, gathered in their hundreds of thousands in Peking to denounce the counter-revolutionary elements, the paper tigers, as they called them, in the older generation. "Political power grows out of the barrel of a gun," Chairman Mao had told them, and they believed him. And China has still not recovered from the decimation of her intelligentsia, which that so-called cultural revolution was responsible for. The scenes Isaiah is describing here in verses 1 to 7 of chapter 3 read almost like a newsreel of those terrible days in China, don't they? Mere boys became officials. Children became governors. And you see the same thing being repeated perhaps on a lesser scale in countless other places, even today. Look at the faces of those bearing machine guns on the streets of Beirut. How old are they? And don't you remember Uganda? Or Ethiopia? Or Iran? Or countless other places that have known revolution and anarchy in the last few years? Revolution and anarchy are the politics of the young every time. And what Isaiah is telling us in these verses is, revolution and anarchy are also the politics of divine judgment. He's quite candid about it. Verse 1. The Lord Almighty is going to strip Jerusalem of its support system in this way. In verse 4, I will make boys their officials. Mere children will govern them. And the result, verse 8, Jerusalem staggers. Judah is falling. A society without experienced and mature leadership is a crippled society. A society doomed to collapse. And Isaiah is telling us that sometimes such collapse, born of revolution and anarchy, is an act of God in the history of such societies. An act of judgment. And that surely is an important lesson for us, isn't it? Particularly those of us who are young. It's all too easy, I know, for youth to poke fun at the establishment. We've all done it. To mock the stuffy generals. To lampoon the elderly professors. To despise geriatric peers of the realm staggering their way into the House of Lords. In the impatience of youth, it's easy to persuade ourselves that if only we could sweep away all this dead weight of old boy network, then how we could create a radical new society overnight. Well, Isaiah would caution us against such impetuous optimism. Better a stick-in-the-mud government, he says, than no government at all. Better a gerontocracy, a rule of the elderly, than the anarchy the young would bring us. For when reckless young men seize political power, he says, it is a sure sign of the judgment of God. That brings us to our second section. The marks of a pre-revolutionary society. Why is it that God allows a nation to fall into such political chaos? Not because he sees revolution as a marvellous shortcut to utopia, that's for sure. But simply because things had got so bad in that country, he couldn't imagine the revolution making things any worse. Isaiah tells us in the following passage, from verse 8 through to 4 verse 1, that the seeds of political anarchy are sown in moral corruption. And he depicts three particular areas of Judah's society where that moral corruption was most evident to him. He starts with corruption in the people at large. Look at verse 8. Their words and deeds are against the Lord, defying his glorious presence. The look on their faces testifies against them. They parade their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to them! They have brought disaster upon themselves, he said. There's an important lesson here. It's not, you see, that God expects people to be perfect. He knows this is a fallen world. Evil is endemic in every society. What made Judah vulnerable to his judgment in this way is that she was brazen about her sin. That's what Isaiah is saying. She defied God's glorious presence, he says. Literally, she defied the eyes of his glory. As we might say, she paraded her sin under his very nose. Why, says Isaiah, you can see the arrogance in their attitude in their very faces. Like an insolent schoolboy daring the teacher to do something about it. They feel no embarrassment about their behavior. It's barefaced contempt for God's standards. A deliberate, shameless public challenge to his moral authority. That's what we're dealing with. And that's what God can't stand. While society has a conscience about its sins, God often is prepared to tolerate a good deal. While public opinion is on the side of decency and morality, he's able to be patient. Even when only a tiny minority of a society are really trying to live by his standards, he can be merciful and patient. The book of Genesis tells us he would have spared Sodom if he just found 10 righteous men in the place. But once society becomes openly defiant, that leniency on God's part is no longer possible. And that, hints Isaiah here in verse 9, was the problem at Sodom. She paraded her sin too. All moral inhibition, all sense of shame was swept aside in her. Immoral behavior became socially acceptable. People were proud of their sin. They even shouted about it on the city streets. And that's why, says Isaiah, Sodom perished, and that is why Judah will perish. Because she didn't even have the grace to blush. They parade their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to them. They have brought disaster upon themselves. Now that seems to me to be an important, vitally important insight for our 20th century Western world. Let's just think for a moment about this question of homosexuality, which James Anderson's remarks have proved so controversial about. It's often said that sexual morality in the Victorian era was just as bad as it is today, just as loose as it is today. It just all went on in secret, they say, behind a veneer of public respectability, which I suppose may very well have been true. And not for one moment do I want to suggest that God is impressed by that kind of Victorian sexual hypocrisy. Nevertheless, I think it has to be said that not since the days of Greece and Rome have people championed homosexuality in public in the kind of aggressive, contemptuous fashion in which it is being championed by some today. Well, I'm not disputing it's all gone on. The private lives of people may well have been sordid cesspools, but people were not proud of the fact. Only in recent years have men and women started to parade their sin like Sodom. Only in recent years have we begun to see not just permissive behavior, but permissive legislation. Not just moral hypocrisy, but moral defiance. That is what is new about our permissive society. Could it be that Isaiah would say of us, "The look on their faces testifies against them. They parade their sin like Sodom. They do not hide it. Woe to them! They are bringing disaster upon themselves." See, in such a situation of utter shamelessness, God must step in to re-establish the credibility of his moral order. That's why Isaiah goes on, "Tell the righteous it will be well with them, for they will enjoy the fruit of their deeds. Woe to the wicked, disaster is upon them, they will be paid back for what their hands have done." He's reassuring the people he's speaking to. Right and wrong matter. They are not mere human conventions which we can define as we will. They are absolutes built into the universe by the one who made it, the one who judges it. Sometimes the best way to teach a society that it cannot arrogantly defy God's standards is to let that society reap the harvest of its own moral license. Woe to them. They have brought disaster upon themselves. Set these words in the context of the whole chapter and you see what Isaiah is saying. Political anarchy is simply the consequence of moral anarchy. It is the mark of a pre-revolutionary society. A people who will acknowledge no rules eventually will have no rulers. The two things go together. But Isaiah wants to go a little further than that. He wants to focus what he has to say about the corruption he sees in the society of his day on two particular groups within the community. First, the government, and then the women. Let's look at them. First, corruption in government as a mark of a pre-revolutionary society. "Youths oppress my people," verse 12. "Women rule over them. Oh, my people, your guides lead you astray. They turn you from the path. The Lord takes his place in court. He rises to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment against the elders and leaders of his people. It is you who have ruined my vineyard. The plunder from the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor?" declares the Lord Almighty. Any of you who have a New English Bible here will have observed that there is a debate among the commentators over the meaning of verse 12, which unfortunately the New International Version doesn't reproduce in the margin. A good case can be made for translating the Hebrew, "Not youths oppress my people and women rule over them, but moneylenders strip my people and extortioners lord it over them." So tempting though it is for those who have it in for Maggie to see women ruling over them as a mark of a pre-revolutionary society, I have to say, it does seem to me that that alternative rendering does fit into this context in this paragraph rather better, and it is supported by the Septuagint. So that's the rendering I prefer to talk about this morning. Isaiah is telling us here, you see, that society generally invites anarchy by the defiance of its God's moral standards. But more than that, that governments invite anarchy too by their failure to check exploitation. That's what he's going about on in this paragraph. While governments legislate wisely, he's saying, while courts are impartial, then God can withhold judgment, even on a corrupt society, because the human machinery of state is sufficient to execute his wrath on the wrongdoer, which according to the Bible is precisely why God ordained the state. But once the moral corruption that permeates the nation as a whole has infected the leadership too, then judgment is inevitable. And if that judgment takes the form of a slide into anarchy, it's easy enough to see why, isn't it? For nothing undermines respect for civil authority more radically than the public corruption of justice. Once people feel that those who wield power over them are wedded to class interests that exclude them, the seeds of revolution are sure to germinate, and particularly among the young. It's happened again and again and again. And that's precisely what was happening in Judah. Those who should have been directing the country in paths of righteousness, says the prophet, were themselves subverting justice. The courts couldn't be relied upon to see fair play anymore. And as a result, the poor, he says, were the helpless victims of their creditors. Moneylenders stripped my people, extortioners lorded over them. God couldn't allow it to go on. If the judiciary would not see justice done, then he would have to set up his own court of appeal. And he had no doubt who would be found in the dock when he did. Verse 13. The Lord takes his place in court. He rises to judge the people. The Lord enters into judgment. Against whom? Against the elders and leaders of his people. It's you who have ruined my vineyard. The plunder from the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by crushing my people and grinding the faces of the poor? So God indicts and cross-examines every corrupt regime. Do you notice the twin foci of his moral indignation? The two plaintiffs, if you like. On the one hand, there are the exploited. The plunder of the poor is in your houses. What do you mean by grinding the faces of the poor? He asks. But on the other hand, there is God himself as plaintiff. It is my vineyard you've ruined. It is my people you've crushed. So important to catch the force of those first-person possessives. Political power is a sacred trust. It isn't just in the name of some abstract justice with a capital J that God calls governments to account. It's not just because he has some sentimental attachment to the poor. It is out of zeal, out of jealousy for his own name. This is my country, he says. These are my people whose faces you are trampling into the dust. How dare you? This isn't just a crime against them, it's a crime against me. Well, let every government on earth reflect on that. No matter, however big its army, no matter how large its majority, no matter how secure it feels politically, no government owns anything. We are not owners, we are stewards of another's property, servants of another king. We'd better be careful how we manage his vineyard. We'd better be careful how we treat his people. For tyranny invites revolution, and injustice invites anarchy, and judicial corruption invites the judgment of God. You know, Le Maistre once made that famous statement, every society gets the government it deserves. I think what Isaiah may be suggesting here is that the reverse is also true. That every government gets the society it deserves. God will not protect corrupt governments from the consequences of their alienation of the poor. Why should he? In cases like that, he's on the side of the poor. And yet there is another focus, isn't there, of this moral corruption too that Isaiah talks about as the mark of a pre-revolutionary society. And in some ways it's the most controversial of all. Corruption among the women of Judah. Look at verse 16. The Lord says the women of Zion are haughty, walking along with outstretched necks, flirting with their eyes, tripping along with mincing steps, with ornaments jingling on their ankles. Therefore the Lord will bring sores on the heads of the women of Zion. The Lord will make their scalps bald. Now before we have a mass walkout, let's quickly note. Isaiah is plainly not referring to all women here, is he? He has fixed his gun sights quite specifically on one particular group, that is the wealthy and glamorous courtesans, I think you could almost call them, of Jerusalem. And he's done so for one fundamental reason. Because these wealthy and glamorous women epitomized in their demeanor and attitude the pride of Judah as a whole. Do you see that in verse 16? The women of Zion are haughty. That's the key phrase. That's where he's starting from. That's why the Lord is against them. You see that haughtiness in their self-conscious exhibitionism, he says. Their outstretched necks. They want everyone to notice. You see it in the blatant seductiveness of their fluttering eyelashes, flirting with their eyes. You see it in their ridiculously unnatural attempts at a graceful gait, tripping along with mincing steps, bells jingling, to draw attention to the pain they were suffering for the sake of fashion. Most of all, though, you see it in their extraordinary obsession with their physical appearance. Most of all, though, you see it in their extraordinary obsession with their physical appearance. The Bond Street jewellery, the Paris haute couture, the Chanel perfume, the Gucci handbag. They had to have it all. They had to show it off. For the women of Zion are haughty. You bet they were. You see, it was pride that was corrupting the nation, arrogantly thinking they could defy God's law with impunity. It was pride that was corrupting the government, complacently thinking they could exploit the poor with impunity. And it was that self-same pride that was corrupting these snobbish women in the capital city. Secure in their luxury, they spent small fortunes on their outfits, while widows were starving at their back doors for the lack of a crust. It wasn't because they were women that Isaiah picks on them. It wasn't even because they were rich he picks on them. It's because they were proud. Proud and selfish and greedy and materialistic. They epitomized the national disease in Judah. And their destiny, therefore, would epitomize the national fate of Judah. In that day, the Lord will snatch away their finery, the bangles and headbands and necklaces and earrings and bracelets and veils, the headdresses and ankle chains, the sashes, the perfume, the charms, the fine robes, the purses, the mirrors, the tiaras, the shawls. Instead of fragrance, there will be a stench. Instead of a sash, a rope. Instead of well-dressed hair, baldness. Instead of fine clothing, sackcloth. Instead of beauty, branding. Once again, Isaiah, you see, has provided us with a little cameo snapshot to drive home to our minds the emotional impact of this disaster he's predicting. These glamorous women who were once so self-confident in their feminine allure, so proud they turned the streets of Jerusalem into a fashion parade. That says Isaiah, in that day of revolution, they will be found reduced to stinking hags, desperately offering themselves to any available man, and there are few enough around after the decimation of the population, but offering themselves to any man who's available to rescue them from prostitution and give them back some remnant of their female dignity. Why, they say, why, he says in verse 1 of chapter 4, in that day seven women will take hold of one man and say, we'll eat our own food and provide our own clothes. Only let us be called by your name. Take away our disgrace. We'll waive the normal property rights of a wife, they'll say. We'll be a slave concubine if that's what you want. But please don't leave us here in the vulnerability of the streets. It's an appalling scene of humiliation, isn't it? Any woman would rightly be horrified at this description. But it's real. That's what you've got to realize. This is what anarchy and revolution does to women. 8 centuries before Christ, 2,000 years after Christ, it's the same story. And all the feminist campaigning in the world isn't going to change it. When the red flag is waved, when the bullets start flying, it is the women who are raped. It is the women who are left without husbands. It is the Marie Antoinettes of this world who suffer the most appalling indignities. And Isaiah is simply saying here, but in the case of some women, at least, they're only getting what they deserve. I hesitate to try to apply this passage. We live in a day when even to raise your hat to a lady is likely to be met with the charge of being chauvinistically patronizing towards her. But it does seem to me there are things here that women, and particularly Christian women, do need to think about, so forgive me if for a moment I draw your attention to them. It seems to me what Isaiah is really pointing out to us in these verses is this, that the clothes a woman wears not only say a lot about her, they say a lot about the society of which she's a part. It's not too much, you know, to say that you can map the decadence of society across the pages of history just by studying female fashion. The way women dress and act is a most revealing index of societal value. The affluence, the permissiveness, the distribution of wealth, they're all there. They can be read like a code out of the pages of Vogue magazine. And that, of course, is why the way a Christian woman dresses is of such importance to the Bible. Let's listen to these words from Peter. Can't find them. Your beauty should not come from outward adornment, says Peter, such as braided hair and the wearing of gold jewelry and fine clothes. Instead, he says, your beauty should be that of your inner self, an unfading beauty, the beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit. Now, I know many Christian women read words like that with embarrassment. Oh dear, they say, should I have had that new hairdo this week? Ought I to wear those pearls? Should I have bought that new dress? As if Peter was advocating in that passage that Christian women should be dowdy and frumpish and unfeminine in what they wear. I'm quite sure that is not his intention. Peter there doesn't object to braided hair, as perhaps some of the Puritans might have done, because it was pretty. He doesn't object to it as some feminists perhaps might, because it conformed to a female stereotype in a male-dominated world. Peter objects to it because the image it projected within the dress conventions of that first century culture he was addressing was totally out of keeping with Christian virtues and Christian propriety and Christian modesty. That's why. He's demanding that Christian women exercise dress sense. They think about what they wear, because what they wear is not just a comment on them, it's a comment on their society. It influences their society. By the way she dresses, a woman either reinforces the extravagance and vanity and sensuality of her world, or she makes her private stand against it. To put it in Isaiah's terms, she is either like the women of Jerusalem, inviting God's judgment by her haughty demeanor, or by her godly example, she is turning it aside. He must never be taken in by this myth that women are powerless in a patriarchal society. What nonsense. Women exert enormous influence on society. They always have done. They have always been the final guardian of moral values. And that is why, though Judah was undoubtedly a patriarchal society, far more viciously so than ours today is, Isaiah holds the women to blame along with everybody else for the corruption he sees in Judah. They were responsible. They would be judged. And that seems to me to be a most solemn thought which Christian women need to think about just as much as anybody else. What are the marks then of a pre-revolutionary society? Corruption. Judah was on the verge of anarchy because the people were corrupt, because the government was corrupt, even the women were corrupt. But that brings us to our third and last section, doesn't it? Hope for a post-revolutionary society. The future is not totally bleak for Isaiah. Quote chapter 4, verse 2. In that day the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious, and the fruit of the land will be the pride and glory of the survivors in Israel. Those who are left in Zion, who remain in Jerusalem, will be called holy. Now, throughout our study today so far, we've thought of Judah as a nation, a society standing under God's judgment, and we've tried to learn lessons from her applicable to our own nation and society, haven't we? But it's important to remember when you read the Old Testament that though Judah was a nation, she was a very unusual nation. She was in a very special sense God's nation, a chosen people, bound to God by covenant relationship that was quite unique. And every now and again you come across a passage in the Old Testament which so reflects that unique privilege which Judah enjoyed that it can't be applied to Britain or America or any modern. And this paragraph we come to now is one such passage. Isaiah is expressing here his inspired conviction that in spite of the corruption he saw in Judah, she would not be utterly destroyed. In spite of the dreadful political consequences of he could see coming on her in God's judgment upon her, there would be, as he says in verse 2, survivors. Like sailors left in a dinghy after the ship has gone down. There will be a small group of men and women left in Jerusalem when the political turmoil is over, he says. A remnant of grace, as a later Bible writer puts it. They will be left there on God's acre, Jerusalem. But he says they're going to be different. The trauma of judgment will have been a cathartic experience for these survivors. They are going to be holy. All the corruption of the past will be gone. No more arrogant courtesans. No more criminal violence in the streets. No, he says, the Lord will wash away the filth of the women of Zion. He will cleanse the bloodstains from Jerusalem. A spirit of judgment and a spirit of fire will purge the people, he says. And as a result of this new moral and spiritual purity in God's people, prosperity will return, he says. The fruit of the land will be back again, fruit in which they can take legitimate pride. Yes, and peace and security will be back in the land too. Look at verse 5. Then the Lord will create over all of Mount Zion and over those who assemble there a cloud of smoke by day and a glow of flaming fire by night. Over all, the glory will be a canopy. This is a marvelous picture. It evokes imagery, for those of you who know it, of the Exodus, when God led the Jews through the wilderness with a fiery, cloudy pillar. That's why these pictures of fire and cloud are there. Only now, you see, it's not a pillar any longer, is it? Isaiah seems to see it as a gigantic hemisphere enclosing the whole city of Jerusalem like an impregnable force field. Nothing will be able to hurt anybody inside that supernatural dome, he says. Even the natural elements will have lost their force. It will be attenuated. The sun won't be able to scorch you. The rain won't be able to batter you. It will be a refuge and a hiding place, a shelter and a shade. For everybody in that city, he says, will know the personal protection of the Lord. What a hope for a society emerging from the dreadful consequences of anarchy and revolution. Eh? Inevitably, we want to ask, when? When did it happen, or when will it happen? Some might want to argue that these words of Isaiah were fulfilled in 701 BC, for that was when Sennacherib came down from the plain, you remember, and attacked Judah. There were miraculously survivors after that Assyrian conquest, and Jerusalem itself was supernaturally delivered on that occasion. But unfortunately, there's no record of the kind of moral improvement that Isaiah looks for here on that occasion. So though it may be a partial fulfillment, it really won't do as the complete story, will it? Others may wish to place this prophecy still into the future. They may want to say that Jerusalem one day will know again this supernatural glory of God dwelling within it, just as it did in the days of Moses. Some Zionists would hope that too. Some Christians would espouse that kind of literalist interpretation of the text. And maybe they're right. But I want to tell you this morning that I am sure of one thing. I'm sure of this, that you do not have to wait to enter this force field of God's protecting presence that Isaiah is talking about, nor do you and I have to take a plane El Al and go to Jerusalem to find it. For what Isaiah anticipated here has already arrived. And the clue to understanding how it has arrived is in the very first line. In that day, the branch of the Lord will be beautiful and glorious. Now, I don't know exactly what Isaiah meant by that. I'm not actually sure he did, either. What I do know is that later prophets, like Jeremiah and Zechariah, read this prophecy, and they took that phrase, the branch of the Lord, and they told us what it meant. In those days, said Jeremiah, God will make a righteous branch sprout from David's line. He will do what is just and right. Judah will be saved, and Jerusalem will live in safety. And this is the name by which he will be called, the Lord our righteousness. That's why the NIV has given that word branch a capital B. It is not clear whether Isaiah attributed messianic significance to that word branch of the Lord there or not. You can take it either way. It's ambiguous. But it is certainly clear that later prophets attributed messianic significance to that phrase. And that phrase is therefore the clue to understanding the fulfillment of this prophecy. You want to know what the branch of the Lord is? It is the Messiah. It's Jesus. And that is by far the most helpful and relevant application of this passage to us today. The prophet was right when he said the people of God couldn't be destroyed. They can't be. He was right when he said that God had a book of life and he would preserve the names of every individual recorded in that book of the living. He was right when he said one day a new, refined, sanctified people of God would emerge, the saints of God. And it was so. For the generation that saw the earthly city of Jerusalem finally fall was the very generation that saw the heavenly city of Jerusalem arise. The Church of Jesus Christ. And that supernatural protection of which Isaiah speaks here is around that church now. It's around us now. Enclosing every child of God, I give them eternal life, Jesus said. They will never perish. No one can snatch them out of my Father's hand. That's what Isaiah is talking about here. The security of the church of God's Messiah. That is his hope for a post-revolutionary society. To tell you the truth, I don't know what will become of Britain and Western society in the years to come. I don't know whether the premonitions of judgment that people like James Anderton are feeling are prophetic or just morbid. I don't know whether the moral corruption that we can see with increasing arrogance on our streets is going to get worse or whether it's going to get better. I don't know whether democracy will triumph or whether we shall have to pass, like so many other decadent societies, through a whirlpool of anarchy and revolution. I don't know the answer to any of those things. But I do know two things. I know that right now, we're not quite on the brink that Judah was. God has given us time. Time to work. Time to pray. Time to heed the prophetic warning. And I do know this too, that whatever happens in the future, there is only one safe place to be. And that's inside the messianic canopy. Inside the Church of Jesus Christ. Inside the hands of God the Father. Now let's pray together.